Okay.
So.
Good afternoon.
There is. There are two things I want to discuss today. One was the code. I wasn't sure how much time to actually spend on this, but the code that I presented this past tutorial. And then I want to talk about web security and have it use that to bring together some of the themes we've been talking about in this class. So, first off, do people have questions on the code from Friday? Did it all seem pretty clear? Were there any parts that you'd like me to go over? I have a few things I want to talk about, but... No questions at all? Perfectly clear? I can, in the test, I can ask about every line in the test, in the program?
Does MongoDB support Cassidian stuff? Like a relational database something?
So you want cascading in what sense?
As in if you change a form key value, you would propagate changes to different tables or different functions, I guess.
Oh, you okay, I see what you mean. You want to I tend to think of that sort of cascading thing as basically database side code, because normally when you design table relationships, you're trying to remove duplication. You actually don't want to be duplicating data between tables. And so if you have one table and you change data in other tables, that means you're replicating it. And replicating is kind of what you don't do most of the time in databases. Is that what you mean? I may have misunderstanding what you're thinking of. Yeah, I mean, and normally you don't replicate things. So when you do that sort of replication, what you're doing is you're basically having the database engine say, okay, I just got this data, now I'm going to have like a stored action procedure. Right? Yeah. So you can do that in MongoDB to have code on the database run. Because you can actually run JavaScript code on MongoDB to do arbitrary things.
Okay, so
I don't believe so. It's not, because in general, there's sub-documents. So you can have documents, say not documents, but that's the closest thing. And I haven't really looked into the sub-document support. But in general, MongoDB is designed to have the different collections be independent for the most part. And you can have, and the relationships you want are more built into your application as opposed to built into the database. Does that make sense? Yeah. Again, if you're trying to do complex relationships between table type things, I would tend to suggest going with a relational database because that's what it's designed for. I mean, really more MongoDB type systems are really more object stores. So it's just you have these objects, you want to make them persistent. And it depends on how you're doing your data modeling. So, I mean, this is one thing I've kind of debated a little bit in this course is how much time and energy to devote to talking about database issues, because certainly a lot of web applications use full-fledged databases, and for good reason. But databases is an entire topic unto itself. And I'm trying to think if I could have spent less time covering some of the other things, and I'm not really seeing the room in the class. If you can think of things I should ditch instead and talk more about databases, I am all ears. But this is one of the complex things about this course is that I'm covering a pretty big technology stack. So certain sacrifices have to be made. So yeah, I definitely have given short shrift to how to model data and applications. We haven't even really covered queries, for example. I'm expecting you to kind of figure that out on your own because the queries you need for your application are really simple. Has anyone had trouble doing that? Doing the query part, like retrieving the objects? One thing I would wanted to potentially augment the assignment with is just include a backup of your of the rooms. Because right now, with the way it stands, I'm guessing your export format will not be identical to the rooms object that we'd been previously using. And so since you're going to change the room's structure, that means the only way for the TAs to evaluate it is to sit there and enter lots of rooms and then export it and then import it and look at that and mess with it. And so that will take more time. So I'm going to update that. I should update that right now while I'm thinking about it. I mentioned that this weekend, but my parents were in town, so all I'm saying is assignments 74. Okay. I think I will get rid of this. This is, I think, the last change I want to make. And please include also how's that? Okay, please include a sample room backup containing at least 3 rooms. Okay. Make the lives of the TAs easy. That's important. Other questions about the... One thing you should... How many of you... I don't know about... But one thing you'll note when you start the assignment... The big difference with the rooms database structure is that the names of the rooms... Well, let me just show you what I'm talking about. It's easier to... Okay, tutorials. So if you look here at the rooms, you'll see that the properties are the names of the rooms. And that's what you use for lookup. But if you look at what's stored in MongoDB, it's just the contents of the object. The name of the object is not stored. In fact, you could say the name of the object in MongoDB terms is the ID that's automatically generated. So if you're going to keep the rest of the code the same, you're probably going to have to add another property here called name. And then you can search for name. And you could generate an index based on it. Yes?
Is it okay to change this kind of object into an array instead of an object of objects?
So if you store it as an array, that means your database has one document. Is that correct?
I'm not entirely sure how it works, but wouldn't it have one document per room?
So if it's an array, then how do you access the title, description, and room exits? You room as index 0, index 1, index 2?
The thing is, here you're essentially storing strings, which are essentially an array of character type objects.
Yes.
A string of length 1, and trying to store it as an array as opposed to an object containing 3 strings is just
actually
problems, especially when it comes to delineating where one ends.
Sorting what? I'm a little confused.
He's asking if you can essentially store the data as an array, but an array of strings is just a really long string. I'm pretty sure the
Okay, this is making no sense to me. Because
The reason why I don't understand arrays as a data storage. So what were you thinking of for arrays? How were you gonna? Were you gonna make basically say there's a room is like an array,
exactly.
And then element 0 is the first room, and element 1 is the next room, and element 2 is a following room, and each of those is objects.
Yes.
How is that stored in MongoDB?
The same way.
Are you storing each element in MongoDB as a document, or are you storing the entire array? Why do you need the array? You're storing it in MongoDB. You access it from the database as you need them. So the way I was thinking of doing your data modeling was you would take the name here of the room, put it as a name property, and then this would become, you know, using Mongoose, for example, you'd model it using your data model would have four, you know, your schema would have four elements. We name, title, description, room exits. Room exits would be an array.
Yeah,
array of strings, the same as before. And then you would, in order to do, to find a particular room, you would do a find one and give your query as name is this string.
Yeah, that's how it works.
And where's the array?
The array is stored in memory, and there's different objects throughout the database. So when you want to...
So you're mirroring the database in memory?
I'm sorry?
You're mirroring the database contents in your application in RAM?
Yeah.
No. The whole point of this is that your persistent store is the database. Otherwise, then there's no point in there even being a database. You're replicating.
It's persistent.
Huh?
It's persistent. That's the point of the database.
Yeah, but you're not using it. Now you're going to have to be subject to race conditions. What if your array and your database get out of sync? What if someone else writes to the database behind your back and your array has an old version?
What if your client doesn't have enough room in RAM for your array?
Exactly. You should only have one room at a time. One document at a time. At most, you might need to load other documents the other rooms that are neighbors. Like, for example, you might see you want to load the current room and the ones that you can exit to. You might want to prefetch those. Like, you could have your client actually grab those and use those to make things pretty. And that's going beyond the assignment. But, like, how would you make your links, say, the title rather than, say, the internal name. The easiest way to do that is just have the interface fetch the current room and all of its exits and use those to populate the links. But, again, I specifically didn't ask for that in the assignment because it would be a little more complicated and I wanted to make it more straightforward. But if you wanted to improve it, that'd be a small way of doing it. But, yeah, you do not keep a copy of everything in the database in memory.
Imagine you're the Department of Motor Vehicles. Now somebody wants to query your database, find it. The police want to query the database, find out if somebody's license is valid. They have to download the entire database of every licensed driver in the province to check for one person.
Yeah, but the main thing to keep in mind with databases is its persistence and concurrency. So that's the persistence and concurrency. So allow for someone else to access it. But I've gotten that question actually a couple of times from people. I've been trying to go, like, what? Array? Sure. But it hasn't made much sense to me what was going on. I think I understand now, but...
Arrays are great.
Yeah. Moving on. Other questions?
Is like the way I ended up storing them was, or like trying to access them was by their like name property.
Mm-hmm.
But like that kind of means that you can't have like two rooms that have the same name, right? Is that kind of in line with your?
Well, the idea was I was thinking the names would be globally unique, but the titles don't have to be globally unique.
Okay, that is
And thus, if you only if you make the interface currently displays the names in the pointer thing. So the way you would do it is you make it only display titles. But that means in order to fetch the titles of the room's exits, you'd actually have to follow those pointers and pull those other documents
up. You need some sort of predictable relationship between the names and the titles, right?
No.
How would you?
No, the idea is that when you're displaying an exit, you would just a room. You would say to populate the exit links. You would just pull up all of those rooms, find out what their titles were, and insert those. Or you'd probably call. What I would do is call one function on the server and let the server do that. But I mean, there are ways, of course, to optimize this and things like that. But this is in fact a reason for data duplication in practice, is to make these kind of things faster. Is like if you included the titles of all the rooms that you had exits for in addition to the names, you don't strictly need that, but it helps for performance because then you only have to pull up one document as opposed to pulling up the number of exit documents for how many exits a room has, which might be like 10 or something. So just a... Let me save this. I just want to walk through a couple of little things in here before going on, because I'm okay. Extract all. Extract. Thank you. Wow. That's really slow. I think it's been about 10 years since I've waited that long for something to unzip that was 11 megs. Really? You know,
a lot of little files.
I guess I'm also used to Linux. Linux is really fast for these kind of operations. GUI stuff isn't necessarily as fast, but the file system operations are blindingly fast. Okay, there we go. Okay, so let's open this. Did I mention that Visual Studio now has support for Node? The latest version of Visual Studio just got support for Node.js with Azure support and everything. So if you want to keep doing Node.js, you can do that. I'll have to look over the breaks to see how good the interface is that I can actually show people that. But I don't think I'm going to have that as the primary thing because I don't even want to think about what it would take to get that running in the labs. I'll just start. So this part, all boring, boring, boring. What was this about? This note. Did you know about that? Did you read that? Did you notice that? I mentioned that this was something that you could do in the assignment to code around it. So we'll talk about it in a second, but then this stuff is all, boring, boring, boring. Here's all our rats, routes, not rats, routes. So this is all, this is about the only interesting thing in this file. So let's first start, what does body parser do? Body parser. What is the body is probably referring to? Yes?
The request body.
That's exactly what it is. Remember when you do a post request, there was a body, and inside that body, there were all these strings, things for the body of the form, whatever came for it, the names and the values. That's in the body of the form. So body parser is on the server side. This is saying, parse the form. And this is a bit of middleware that hooks up. If you look at what body parser is, it depends on this package, and it goes, there's a few levels in there. Because, in fact, it's doing a bunch of different things. Like, if some stuff comes up in JSON format, it'll take it from JSON and actually encode it into a JavaScript object. If a file comes up, it will take that file, just basically think of it like an email attachment. Email is pure text,
but you can email binary files like images. You're all familiar with, you've heard the term mime, right? M-I-M-E. Wow, end of the semester indeed. Chalk is getting small. Multi-part internet mail extensions, I think is what it stands for. So if you ever look at the raw source of an email message, which you all probably do not do very often, I did this for various reasons, my graduate career, but that's another story. It's very messy. It's very, very messy if you look at the raw parts of a modern email message. Old emails, plain text emails, should all look kind of nicely, but now almost everything is MIME formatted. And so it's all these garbage of like, here's a header, here's a type, here's a thing. And what it is, this is a standard for turning a stream of text, which was designed to just be people chatting, into a generic transport layer to be able to send almost anything. You want to send a web page, it knows it's a web page. You want to send an image, it knows it's an image. This is how your messages can have different fonts and everything, is because it's all specified using MIME. Part of MIME is a standard for encoding binary in text. Anyone know what the standard way of encoding binary to text nowadays is? Base 64, yes. Yeah. Base 64 encoding says that you're encoding this is as text. Well, it's like you're encoding something in base 10, except it's base 64. So instead of 0 through 9, you have 0 through 9 and then all these other ASCII characters that are used for encoding it, because you have uppercase, you have lowercase. So yeah, so it's 26 uppercase, 26 lowercase, that's 52. And then plus the numerals, which is, that gives you 62. And I guess there's two more that's used.
Percent and equals, I
think. Yeah. But equals in what, sorry?
Percent.
Percent, okay. So this is just, this is necessary because you had to pick letters that wouldn't be interpreted by the email programs. Like new line, tab, carriage return, these are ASCII characters. They are, but the problem is they are not necessarily respected by the email transport. Different email servers along the way, because email is relayed from server to server to server. Different mail servers down the way, where you look at those spaces and go like, oh, I can delete some of those spaces. Those aren't important. Oh, those tabs, I can convert those tabs to spaces. It will do various encoding changes. And so this is designed as a subset that won't get transformed. So basically, you take a binary thing, you encode it in base 64, and then on the other side, you decode it from this. So you get a slight expansion, but it's not too bad. This is the same kind of stuff that can often happen in HTTP, simply because HTTP is defined as a textual protocol. They're extensions to a binary, but by default, it's text. So how do you encode binary things in text? Why made a new standard when you got old standards? So there's things like Base64 encoding sitting there. And so you got to have a parser to do this sort of thing. So what you actually have is something that gets the form. If there's a file encoded in the form, it will go through, just like an email attachment, it will go through, parse it, and then extract the file. But now it has a file. Where does it put the file? What does it do with the file? It makes up a random file name and puts it in a designated temporary directory. Given this description, how do you mess with the server? Send it lots of forms with lots of files. And it just starts creating files on your server in the temp directory. And it turns out virtually every system has a limit on how many files that can exist on the system. That is much smaller than the total storage capacity of the file system. In other words, you could make it so that you exhaust So it's exhausting all the inodes is what it'd be on a Unix system, but you can do this to any most file systems. And so all of a sudden now you created as many files as that file system can create, and what happens to the web server? It goes because probably it's going to need to create a file at some point, and then it can't, and then it just starts having errors, and you basically have a denial of service attack. So that's what the whole problem with this line is, and why it's warned and why it's deprecated, is because the standard body parser creates temporary files automatically without any verification, and that this can be used by an attacker to create arbitrary numbers of temp files. So how do you resolve this? Well, one way to resolve this in practice is just to have some other program watch the temp directory and clean it up. But the other way of doing it is to do something where you just don't create the files if you don't need to. But that's an API change. And so I suspect in the next 6 months, this is going to be when the new version of Express and stuff, they'll have a somewhat different API for doing this. But for right now, it's kind of like, oh, you've got, if you use body parser, you're subjecting your node application to a denial of service attack. Because you would just have to upload files of like 1 byte. Wouldn't necessarily take much bandwidth, but then you could just send all these 1 byte files to the server. It would create millions of files, and all of a sudden, keel over. So that's something we will talk about more in a second. But that's why there's a warning, is because they realized that they had this very old vulnerability, which has been around for a long time. They realized they'd re-implemented it, and then they had to change their API so it wasn't there, if they wanted to make it safe by default, which these guys are trying to do, which is good. Okay, so now the other thing. So the other thing I wanted to look at here was, okay, so here, so we're using Mongoose. So what are you losing by using Mongoose versus standard MongoDB? Mongoose is a layer on top of it. What are you losing?
Having like collections of documents that don't necessarily have the same scheme to them. Like
that's exactly what it is. With Mongoose, you're enforcing a schema. You're saying every document has to have all of these properties. If you want to have your document collection be more heterogeneous, Mongoose is not a good fit. But if you want to have a homogeneous collection, you want every document to be the same in structure, then it's a good fit. Note that if you are doing something with Mongoose, moving it to a more standard relational database is much more feasible than if you don't do something like Mongoose and you have something more heterogeneous. Because then, how do you fit that into a standard relational database? I mean, that's a pain. So, if your application fits Mongoose's use pattern, you could probably go to something like MySQL or whatever very easily. If it doesn't fit Mongoose, you might want to stick with MongoDB, or at least think about why you need something like that. So this is actually very traditionally databasey. So here we've got this. So this Mongoose. So what are all these variables here? So FS, require FS. That's just used. Do I even use FS? Where do I use FS? Oh, the upload. Right, yeah, using the upload. Yes, that's exactly where I use it. Sorry. I was trying to remember why I had it there. Because I put everything here for a reason. So, Mongoose, we're loading the Mongoose module. DB is mongoose.connection. So, this is just a method of Mongoose. And this is an undefined variable here. And then we do mongoose connect.
So what does Mongoose Connect, do you think, do?
It connects your application to the server containing your database?
Exactly. So what we're doing right now is we're saying Mongoose Connect says, connect to MongoDB on localhost and with the collection DB demo people. Now remember, this is Node, so this is asynchronous.
We just fire this off. We don't know whether we're actually connected or not. So what we do is instead add this little error message says that if our database, so Mongoose Connection, so basically that's just mongoose.connection.on error, send to the console MongoDB connection error. I think I just could have just said console.log there. But. Yes?
Sorry, just the bind seems that console.log just sends a message. Error.bind suggests to me that it's doing something more, like it's locking things up until you acknowledge that, oh yeah, there's an error, it's a big one.
Oh right, I think you're right. I think that does. I have to check when you trigger that error. Does you can't do anything more with the database. It crashes, right? I think yeah. So, which is good. So what this means is you set up something asynchronous, and then if there's an error in connecting to the database, your application will stop running. Not necessarily the most fault tolerant thing, but at least it's clear.
Opposed to just sort of processing incoming. I mean, in general, you'd rather have an application refuse connections rather than accept connections than not do anything. And in general, if a web application can't talk to its database, it's pretty dead. So once we get to this point, we've kind of set up everything that if we're going to keep running, we're connected to the database. And now we set up this, you know, we say set up people database as a function. And so all this function does is it, you know, sets up a schema. So it says mongoose.schema, and it gives it an object with a proper, you know, with these properties, and they're referring to standard objects that Mongoose knows about. And then I think these are constructors that it knows about. And then you pass, so this is there. And then you say this model thing, person schema. So,
and you know, what's the relationship between this schema stuff and model stuff in Mongoose? So, in Mongoose, there's this idea of you have a schema which describes how your objects are laid out, but this is not the representation that is used. This is just the human readable form. When you create the model is the compiled form of the schema. The model is what lets you actually do stuff with the database. So you create a schema, and then you instantiate a model, which is basically you're instantiating a data model using the schema. And we're saying the schema that we're instantiating, we're going to call it person. It's using the person schema. And we're assigning it to a person variable, which we declared above, so it's in the bright scope for everyone else.
So is that like equivalent to the SQL's create table function?
Not exactly. Because this is not server side. Well, this is not database server side. This is all in the application server. This is not storing anything. This is about constraints. So the nice thing about using something like Mongoose is it gives you a way to use MongoDB and have constraints on the data. So it's not, what the first constraint is, here are the properties here. But you can add in all other kinds of constraints, like saying, like, does the email address have an at sign in it? Does it refer to a domain that you can look up in DNS? Does this date, is it actually for a reasonable time period? You know, is it within the past 100 years? You know, you can add triggers to this to say this is validated, this is not. That's what the model is all about. The schema is the first part of that. So what this gives you the schema, and then the model, you can extend it with other functionality.
So the schema is like defining your columns?
Exactly what it is. Yes. But it's, so it's a very, it's the base level of your model. But it's not the, you can do all the other kinds of things with your data model in Mongoose.
So the schema defines what the columns are, and then the model, you can include restrictions on the data in those columns.
Yes. And how they, you know, how they relate to each other. Yes?
So what's the advantage of this kind of database over a SQL database?
So if you're looking for the advantage of this, in general, when you go to non-SQL type things, it's almost all less functionality for more performance. The one advantage that something like MongoDB does have is heterogeneity. But in most applications, that's not a win. What it does give you, though, is it does have certain, it in principle has certain scalability advantages because it doesn't require quite as much coordination. There's a little bit of controversy, I would say, in the web application world as far as what sort of database should you back your system by. And some people would say you should never bother with something like MongoDB either. You just go for something really simple like a key value store if that's all you need, and that's crazy scalable. And if you need something more complicated, you go for a full relational database. But there's lots of use cases. Yes?
You should show the MongoDB's web scale video.
Web scale video? Oh. How long is it? It's like
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. I'll okay, that's true. I can make a, that's a good idea.
We should turn the volume down.
Okay, right. Is that on their main site? I don't know if I've actually watched that. It's like,
just Google it.
Okay.
There's a site for it.
Okay. We'll do that in a second here. But anyway, so it's much more, it's not about functionality. These all basically have less functionality. The question is, do they have enough functionality? Although I would say, actually, there is one advantage, I would say, for MongoDB as a web developer that's not that. This is a security advantage. Because you're, in general, not doing queries using an embedded language. The separation between your query language and your data is very simple. And most of the time, when you're doing something with like SQL, you're often assembling SQL queries, which is a complete string. And so there's a big possibility for attacks in doing that. So, but honestly, I have not done a proper security analysis of MongoDB's interface, so I cannot say that for sure. But that is a possibility. Anyway, what I was saying was this is a so we're getting a schema, and the schema is our basis of our model, but it is not our entire data model, although that's all it is in this application, because they haven't added any validation rules. But this doesn't actually do anything. What this is says, once the database is actually connected, then set up this. You know, then that function will be called. So this function's only going to be called once the database is open. What's the advantage of that? Well, that means that this model can actually be instantiated versus the actual database, and it can do all the coordination prefetch things. And now, when you want to do operations, you can do operations directly on the database. In Mongoose terminology, the model's useless unless it's connected to a database. And so then now, so once the database is in, this stuff will only be valid once the database is open. So that means anything referring to person, notice person will be undefined until this code is run. So the rest of our application will actually know whether the database is all operational and functional based on the value of person. So you could actually have the rest of your code, if you, for added robustness, if you didn't want to do this sort of DB on error, you could have a check, do we have a valid model? And
that could then say, we don't have a valid model, but something must be wrong. Well, okay, site is in maintenance mode. Well, we have an internal error. Please, you know, contact the system and help. So this renders our front page, add person. This is all simple. The add. So note what we can do here. The way Mongoose works is, it will first off, it's using constructors, which, remember, in our JavaScript, the good parts, they say don't do that, but hey, these guys decide to do it. And it kind of looks okay here. We're not the ones creating the stuff with the prototypes and stuff in the back end, so we don't really care. But here it's saying the person is a new person, which is just an object that we've created out of the properties that are passed to us from the form. How did these values come to us? Where's rec body name? This right off from right here. So, and then here is save callback. So here, say the person save callback. So what's this being called? This thing, we have a person here that we got here that we created. Just because we created this new person doesn't mean it's actually been committed to the database. The commit only happens here. And in fact, that commit may fail. And that's why we have this callback. And it's saying that we're going to return the results of the add and basically say, did it actually get added or not? Because the operation of the database could have succeeded or could have failed. Notice that we don't actually send a response back to the client until this render actually succeeds, which means after the save. Let's say the save takes 10 seconds. What will happen to the browser that made the save request for those 10 seconds? It will hang. What will happen to other requests coming into the web server? They will get processed.
They will get processed.
They will get handled with no problem. The only client that will hang is the one that is waiting for this. How would you get rid of that hang? How could you instead maybe have a progress bar, have a little spinning wheel? How would you implement that here? Just basic, you know, just a basic strategy.
Put it in function.
It's going to be a function vault, yes. but where, how, what? Basic strategy is you wouldn't put this res render inside of this callback. What you would actually do is put the res render here and it would return the page immediately. But the page it would return would basically say save in progress. And it would have a little spinning wheel and it would have AJAX calls which would pull the server. And it would have a status, basically you maintain some status variable saying, like, has this save actually finished or not? And it would keep checking maybe every second or so and say, has it finished yet? Has it finished yet? Or has it not? And when it has, then it would say, okay. And then your AJAX page then could, you know, redirect to another page or load something else or do whatever. But the basic strategy is the server is set off an asynchronous request. You don't know how long it takes. So you put some code on the client, which checks back with the server periodically, or maybe you could do server-side push. There's a lot of strategies for how to do that. But the client is doing its own little interface while the server is doing who knows what. And you'll see this all over the web every time you find yourself waiting on a page to do something. This is what's happening. Yes?
So say you put the res render after the callback? Outside of the callback, and you keep another res render inside of the callback. Can you technically have...
You can't return two things.
So you would need the AJAX then.
Right. You can't, because once you've returned the page, you've responded to the request. The browser won't be expecting any other responses.
Could you do a send, like multiple sends?
You can, but then that requires you have to have some code on the browser basically waiting for those. But the send is again also in response to a get. It's just a way of responding to a get.
So was it coming here? Yes.
You can do that as a nested Ajax call within an Ajax call, but then it requires four different Ajax calls back to back, and then you gotta play around with which one is gonna come at you first. So that's the problem with which one is gonna come at you first, because it's not asynchronous.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand what a nested Ajax call is.
That's what they call it in a book.
I know it is. I mean, but if you think, I mean, I understand what it's talking about. But if you really parse it, it's kind of funny, because an Ajax call is a call to the server, which normally blocks in some way, but it's happening in the background, so you don't care. So it's it doesn't block. I mean, it's a request, and that it's a request, and it's happening, and whenever the response comes, the browser deals with it.
I think what he needs is the callback to be another Ajax call.
Yeah, I mean, you can do one call and then do another call from within it. Like, you have one Ajax call, you do that, once you get the response, you then do another. And then you could chain them. I'd rather think of them as chaining them as opposed to sort of nesting. But, yeah, but the syntax would probably be kind of nested inside functions and stuff. So, yeah.
If you're doing that for fails and return, you have to do both.
Yeah.
And the problem is that one of them can return before another one returns, and then you get two returns. That's difficult.
That's why, in general, you don't want to do that. Yes?
I had a problem that I ran into a bunch of times while doing the assignment, where, like, I wanted to save multiple documents and only return the page after all of them had saved, but, like, because I was just, like, saving them. Like, you can't know which one's going to save first or last, right? So you don't know which one to attach any callback function to. So I ended up just saving them and returning right away and just, like, hoping nothing bad happened.
Which is exactly the MongoDB why the default was to just... I mean, the standard MongoDB interface, the original one, was just to send saves off to the database, and you never check to see whether they succeeded or not. Mm-hmm. You sort of fire them off, and you assume they're done.
You did want to do that, I guess what I would have wanted is some sort of like waterfall thing where after each save, like the next save happens until all of the documents have saved, and then the final callback function gets called. Is there like some sort of method for doing that?
There are various ways of doing sequential processing in Node. There are I haven't really talked about any of them. I haven't really used them, but. There are ways to so it looks more like classic sequential code. But in general, what you're describing is not something I'd want to do. What I'd say is, if you've got a bunch of things to save, you would give each of them have each of them have their own callback, and then have another as part of the, and then have some coordination between those callbacks for saying that there's something happening. Now you might say, well, when are you going to send a response to the browser? Well, you have to have some code in the browser that would check. Like, for example, you could have very simple saying, keep a count of how many documents have been saved so far. And then when it gets to 5, you just have, then you can actually keep track of the progress bar. Something like that. So, but you see, I mean, flatten it.
Yeah.
It's not what you classically do, but that's actually one reason why I really like the architecture of Node. Is because it forces you to think in ways that are actually better for concurrent applications. Because you aren't thinking synchronously. If you do think synchronously, it looks messy. And when it looks messy, that means you're doing things too synchronously.
Have you used the sulearn upload file thing yet?
I don't know if I have, actually.
I can't tell if the browser hangs when you upload something or not. You don't get any progress.
See, now you have an idea what the code looks like on the server that's doing that. It got some code in, and it's basically waiting to send you the response until it processes it. And now you'll notice that good web applications don't do that. They do it more. The modern standard is you have a little bit of Ajax code sitting in the browser that
keeps in contact with the server so that it knows when the operation is completed. So this is, this is just sort of nesting. The backup, notice the backup is just stupid because all I do is I just send the data structure and I let the browser person figure out how to save it. I think I could set a MIME type for this, a content type for this to tell the browser to do that. There's lots of automatic content type recognition inside of Node. Well, inside of the Express framework, it does a lot of this thing saying, oh, this is an image, so I should send it this way. Oh, this is a text file, so I should send it this way. It does that for you underneath the hood. And in general, it's nice not to have to mess with it, but you can change it. And then here, restore select, this is all. So what is this stuff here? What did I put this in there? I won't have this for each method if it's not an array. So let me at least check to see if it's an array before doing this. That's a stupid kind of validation. What you really should do is walk the entire database and see if it has the right structure. Walk the entire upload and check to see if it has the right structure.
Did the top button work?
What?
Top one?
This works.
I mean, is it as robust as the for each loop?
I'm saying is this, what this will do is it makes sure that you can do this for each.
Huh.
It doesn't make sure that any of the stuff inside here will work. Because I'm accessing properties of this. If you look, well, actually all I do here is I just take each document in there, I assume it's an object, I just throw it to MongoDB. Although what I am doing is I am doing this using new person. So I am relying a bit on Mongoose to do some checking for me. I expect Mongoose would generate an error, though I haven't really played around with that too much. It should generate an error. Like if you give it a document that doesn't match the schema, it should complain. But I don't have anything handling that. So this isn't particularly robust. And actually, while you might want to use something like Mongoose to check your data model as you're processing individual objects, on any sort of import, I wouldn't rely on it. It makes more sense to do it in batch. Check all of them at once for certain things, as opposed to doing it each time. But it's doing some simple checking because we just have a file now that we have to. We've just got a JSON object. Why is it coming as an array? Because remember we were talking a bit about arrays and how you think, well, don't do it in arrays. But why is there an array here?
So it's returned from the find.
The find operation returns an array of results. And that's all we're doing here is just restoring an array. It's an array because that's what we dumped it as. But that's all. That's the only reason there's an array here. Mm-hmm.
Is it like a node convention or something to not indent callback function?
Oh, no. That's just... I'm not sure why it didn't get indented. It should have gotten indented. What? Oh, you mean this one?
Well, that's going to...
Yeah, this should have been... No, this, that's not a node convention. That's just...
That formatting.
Yeah, I think this is tab issues, because I don't think it looked like this when I was editing it, but I have to, yeah. I'm used to editors that will automatically, if you hit tab, it takes it to the right column location, as opposed to just indenting it further. Anyway. So we've got, So it just so all so but all knows all we do have to do the database is we just do this and then we import it and then we check to see if it is, and on the console it's logged whether it's successfully restored each person. And notice all we send here is restore in progress. I don't know how long the restore is going to take. What happened to the old documents in the database? Yeah. Remember, that's what this code is. Person remove, I give it empty criteria, and so then it just remove. When you give it this sort of thing, you're basically saying remove everything. Yeah?
If that's a callback, then are we technically adding people before it might be finished removing everything?
True. Although, as I understand it, this is one command to Mongoose, to MongoDB. That's one reason, because one way you could have done this is iterate through the database on every object. And if you iterated through the database on every object, then yeah, you would certainly, I don't know how long that would take because each of those would happen individually. But all I've done is one. And I believe this one command translates to one operation on MongoDB, and so it just goes there, and so that's in line, that's going to remove everything, and then the other thing's going to happen.
Oh, yeah, so Mongo has its own call stack.
Yeah, well I'm assuming that, you know, the order inside of your code does matter. This is going to get sent off before this gets sent off. That will have a sequence. These commands will be sent there. Now, when they're processed by MongoDB is up to it, but I certainly have serialized one happening before the other. So, the only reason why this, what if this somehow was not synchronous in terms of giving the entire command to MongoDB to say delete everything, there could be a problem. But it's certainly an assumption here, which is generally safe with these sort of database interfaces, is that when I run this command afterwards, that entire command has been queued up at the database, and it will execute that. But you're right. Like, think of a distributed system. Having everything be deleted first and then doing the inserts could be problematic.
It's hard to see, but I think you're actually adding within the callback. After,
am I? Oh, yeah, oh, wait.
Yeah, it's all part of this.
Oh, yes, I did it right. That's why the indentation, yes. Because you're right, you're right, no, I'm doing it right, as opposed to waiting to afterwards. Forget what I just said. Is there a way to, in Visual Studio, just to have it re-indent some code?
Press tab, or you can select
multiple. I just pressed tab, and it just moved it over where it didn't belong.
Edit, advanced.
Format selection. Ah. Thank you. Huh? Much better. Yeah. So that's right. Function error. And then it imports. Yes. Wait for the results. Okay. I will put that video on, and then I'll talk a little bit about security. So, aside from the colorful language, I will say that actually is basically dead on. In the sense that modern, the issues with scalability aren't encountered by most web firms. The only issue is if you're wanting to eventually scale. If you basically believe you're building a business that's eventually going to become web scale, when I say web scale, I really mean you're going to have a copy of the web in your system, or you're going to be working at that sort of vast data scales, then, you know, then all these things make sense. But also it's a question of how much hardware you have to throw at the problem. So,
having said that, I don't like relational databases in many ways. The fact that it's a technology from the 70s shows. MySQL is a very old language.
The pink who was being bad-mouthed, is he the guy who likes the 70s? I didn't really get it. Was he with that, or was he with the new technology?
No, So the guy who was using the more colorful language was basically saying that you should be using the battle-tested old technology if it works for your application, and for almost all of you, it will work.
For the people who have skills beyond what I can handle, you're probably not, you can afford to make your own. You're Walmart or Google or Amazon.
Now, this does dovetail with one big thing, though, that actually I think is not normally considered in these discussions, which is security. And the fact is, when you use complex technologies that give you lots of functionality, they tend to cause you problems in a security sense because they give you functionality you don't need. I mean, if you're using this big system and you're using this much of its functionality, what is that other functionality doing? It's just sitting around. It's either costing you cycles in terms of slowing your application down, but if it's well optimized, it may not be doing much of that. But what that other functionality is doing is it's waiting for someone else to come along and say, here, why don't you try doing this? And this gets directly at a big class of attacks, which is known as SQL injection attacks. So this is a huge problem for web applications, which you mostly do not have if you use something simpler than SQL. So anyone know, this is the whole Bobby drop table stuff we talked about earlier with the XKCD comic. The idea is that when you get input from a user, you're going to use that input to query a database. But now, the input, the untrusted input for the user is going to, can potentially be inserted into a query, which can do arbitrary things to your database, including delete all data in it. How do you know that little bit of untrusted data won't corrupt the rest of your query, the rest of your operation? In general, you don't. I mean, there's various best practices of how to do this so you don't mess up. But the easiest way to do it is just to assemble a string and send it to the database. And it's the least safe one. And that's, I would say that is actually my biggest objection to using SQL in web applications, is it's so easy to do wrong. And in fact, doing it wrong is the easy way of doing it. And so any sort of technology path where the easy way of doing it is the wrong way of doing it, is suspect to me. And you can hide the SQL interface behind things, but let's face it, very few applications need SQL. You're mostly not doing that sort of complex thing. And
I'm not saying that something simpler like MongoDB necessarily gives you all you want, but the fact that it actually has less functionality is potentially a feature, not a bug. Not just for scalability, but just for simple security.
So this actually gets into what I wanted to finish up with, was just thinking a bit about what we're talking about with web attacks and why the web is so... I really got interested in web technologies because I'm a security guy, sort of. If you look at my research is based in computer security, but from an unusual angle. But I got into web security because I was interested in security, and it turns out web security is horrible. I mean, it is the most insecure applications you'll find out there. We basically have figured out how to code securely in C, or at least to patch it up so it's mostly
good enough. C, C++, Java sort of, except when they mess up the C part in programming it. It's things, but compared to all that, it's bad on the website. And it's because of the design of web applications that that's a problem.
It's because you've got before I start with two boxes, let's start with one box. Let's say this is your desktop app. I'm modeling it as a box because this, I'd say, is your program and memory, your code and data sitting inside of address space. It's all running inside the box. How do you compromise the security of this program? Basically, you change, you give it bad input. That's essentially how you compromise any program. You give it bad input of some kind. If you're really violating its security. What happens is you give it bad input, you then cause it to behave in a way that you don't expect, the program didn't anticipate, and all of a sudden you violated whatever security properties you wanted. Some data has been, confidentiality has been breached or whatever. So this is software security. There's also communication security. So communication security is saying we've got Alice, and we've got Bob, and they are communicating. And the attacker, call him M, it's malicious. Attacker can't get to Alice or Bob, they're separate, but can control the communications channel. Can either read what's going through this communication channel or modify it arbitrarily. Get an intruder in the middle attack, you can get, you know, confidential stuff. So this is what crypto is, the classic solution for communication security. And what crypto does is it makes sure that no one can mess with this. And there are limitations to crypto, and it's not a pro thing, but it can actually do this pretty well when configured right. The problem comes when you just bypass this. And this is where web applications are really nasty. It's because what you've done is you've taken your nice little box where you have untrusted input coming in here, and you've broken it in two. You split it. Your program now is resident. Part of it's here, and part of it's there. And it's not just two parties. What you have instead is you have a server here. These are your clients. You've got an unknown number of clients talking to your server, and some of them are malicious. And some of them are good. Some of them are running your code. Some of them are running modified versions of your code, or the attacker's code exclusively. But they're still talking to your server. So all the issues of bad input are multiplied exponentially because the bad input can come in so many different forms. How do you have bad input? Like, you have problems of bad input here. Normally it's not much to compromise on the attacker's side, but what they're doing is they're saying, oh, let me send something to the server and I try compromising it. Or let me send something here and then let me compromise this client over here, which then can then be used to compromise things on the server. You take this graph and traverse it in arbitrary ways, and that's what web attacks look like. Is there this mix of software security and communication security with lots of untrusted endpoints? So all kinds of weird things are getting fed, not just at your application's front door, but also at levels that you'd normally consider to be internal APIs. It's like someone going in and messing with a memory inside of your application. Or this is running on untrusted hardware. We do have software that runs that sort of model. Think copy protection, digital rights management. And what happens to that? It gets broken all the time. But this is worse, because you've got all this trusted stuff here and untrusted stuff here, and it's all split up, and all these attacks are a form of that. So when I talk about SQL injection, what it is it's a client sending a weird string to the server, and actually this isn't one server, this is now your application server talking to a database. You're not compromising the application server, you're just sending data that this one's not doing its proper job, and you're sending a command here. And that's because the server is trusted by the database. The server does not trust the clients, but its trust is being abused because the database will do whatever the server asks it to do. So it's like you're basically you're getting tricked to give a command to your friend to say, "Oh, butterflies are beautiful." You say this to your friend. Someone said, "Well, tell your friend butterflies are beautiful." Turns out your friend is completely scared of butterflies and like goes into a panic attack when they hear the word butterflies, and all of a sudden now, butterflies! And they're so scared and they keel over and they have a heart attack. It's like, "I didn't mean to kill him." Normally this person is so paranoid, they'd only talk to people they trust. They don't let anyone else talk, because all their friends are supposed to know, don't tell them about butterflies. But maybe you thought, "Well, actually, it wasn't a butterfly. I just told them about moths are beautiful." You didn't realize that moths are really the same thing as butterflies for this paranoid, so actually said, "Moths are beautiful." That's the kind of stupid stuff that is happening in your web application. This is abuse of trust. So what's better, for example, is why does the server have the ability to do all kinds of crazy things to the database? Maybe the server shouldn't be so trusted. Why is the language that I'm using to talk to it so complicated that you can insert these really weird things into it? Maybe I should simplify the communication path. That's where architectural choices and technology choices can affect your overall security of your system. Yes?
Part of the problem may be in the origins of the web. It was originally for researchers at universities talking to each other, and they inherently tended to trust each other. That was for collaboration.
So that's an often cited. That's an often cited thing for the internet, saying that, you know, if we had just known better. If we had just known what the internet was going to be used for, we would have built it in a more trustworthy fashion. There's just one problem with that. There does not exist another system in design or conception that does what the web does today. In fact, most of what we do on the web, people before would have just said, "You can't do that. You're going to allow people to just download arbitrary programs and run them on your computer, and it's going to basically be okay? You're crazy." You know, you're going to be exchanging data and have these distributed systems full of millions of systems, and it's going to scale up and deal with petabytes of data, exabytes, and it's all going to work? Like, that's impossible. I mean, yet we built it. So the only trouble with that is that it's not so much that we could... if people have been paranoid, they would do it. It's like, if people were really paranoid at the beginning, they couldn't have built what we built. It would have been impossible. And in fact, by the rules of how you've standardly designed secure systems, the web is impossible. So, I agree that it's like, if you thought about security more, but more closely with that slang thing about security, you just don't do stuff you do. And in fact, so what in practice is we're breaking the rules and we're having to figure out completely new ways of doing things. We're out of time, sorry. So,
So I will stop there, and I'll finish up with security next lecture, and then we'll review on following Monday.